and she'd imagined him to be. A shame that Odium had seen her killed. That was the way Renarin had to present it to himself. Better to turn his pain against the enemy than to lose his father along with his mother. "I have stared Odium in the eyes," Dalinar said. "I have faced him. He expected me to break. By refusing, I upended his plans. It means he can be defeated, and equally important, it means he doesn't know everything or see everything."
"Yes,"
Renarin said, walking across broken glass to look up at the enormous depiction of Odium.
"I don't think he's omnipresent, Father. Well, part of him is everywhere, but he can't access that information. Any more than the Stormfather knows everything the wind touches. I think Odium might see like I do. Not events or the world itself, but possibilities. This war is dangerous for us, Father. In the past, the Heralds would organize our forces, fight with us for a time, but would then return to lock away the souls of the fused in damnation, preventing their rebirths. That way, each fused we killed was an actual casualty. But the Oath Pact is broken now, and the fused cannot be locked away."
"Yes," Dalinar said, moving to stand beside Renarin. "I've been thinking about this myself, trying to determine if there was a way to restore the Oath Pact, or to somehow otherwise make the enemy fear. This is new ground for both us and Odium. There must be something about this new reality that unnerves him. Is there anything else you see?"
"See the blackness that will be, Renarin," Gliss said.
"Friction between the two of you," Renarin said, pointing up at the stained glass. "And a blackness interfering, marring the beauty of the window. Like a sickness infecting both of you, at the edges."
"Curious," Dalinar said, looking where Renarin had pointed, though he'd see only empty air. "I wonder if we'll ever know what that represents."
"Oh, that one's easy, Father," Renarin said. "That's me."
"Renarin, I don't think you should see yourself as—"
"You needn't try to protect my ego, Father. When Gliss and I bonded, we became something new. We see the future. At first I was confused at my place, but I've come to understand. What I see interferes with Odium's ability. Because I can see possibilities of the future, my knowledge changes what I will do. Therefore, his ability to see my future is obscured. Anyone close to me is difficult for him to read."
"I find that comforting," Dalinar said, putting his arm around Renarin's shoulders. "Whatever you are, son, it's a blessing. You might be a different kind of radiant, but you're radiant all the same. You shouldn't feel you need to hide this or your spren." Renarin ducked his head, embarrassed. His father knew not to touch him too quickly, too unexpectedly. So it wasn't the arm around his shoulders. It was just that, well, Dalinar was so accustomed to being able to do whatever he wanted. He had written a storming book. Renarin held no illusions that he would be similarly accepted. He and his father might be of similar rank, from the same family, but Renarin had never been able to navigate society like Dalinar did. True, his father at times navigated society like a chul marching through a crowd, but people got out of the way all the same. Not for Renarin. The people of both Alethkar and Aesir had thousands of years training them to fear and condemn anyone who claimed to be able to see the future. They weren't going to put that aside easily, and particularly not for Renarin.
"We will be careful," Gliss thought. "We will be safe."
"We will try," Renarin thought to him. Out loud, he merely said,
"Thank you. It means a lot to me that you believe that, Father."
"You will ask him," Gliss said, "so my siblings can be?"
"Gliss wants me to note," Renarin said, "that there are others like him. Other spren that Ja'anat has touched, changed, made into whatever it is we are."
"What she does is not right," corrupting Spren?
If I'm a blessing, Father, how can we reject the others? How can we condemn the one who made them? Ja'anat isn't human and doesn't think like one, and I believe she is trying to find a path toward peace between singers and humans, in her own way.
Still, I've felt the touch of one of the unmade, Renarin.
And by one you judge the others?
Renarin didn't say it, though.
People too often said things as soon as they popped into their heads. Instead, he waited.
How many corrupted Spren are we talking about? Dalinar finally asked.
Only a handful, Renarin said. She won't change intelligence Spren without their consent.
Well, that's valuable to know. I'll consider it. Are you in contact with her?
Not in months. Gliss is worried at how silent she's become, though he thinks she is somewhere near right now.
She creates in us a faction loved by neither men nor odium, Gliss agreed. No home, no allies. She might be destroyed by either. We will need more, like you and like me, together.
Around Renarin, the stained glass windows began to crumble. It took Stormlight an effort by Gliss to recreate them, and he was plainly getting tired. Gradually, Renarin's world became normal.
Let me know if she contacts you, Dalinar said.
And if any of these episodes come upon you, bring them to me. I know a little of what it is like, son. You aren't as alone as you probably think.
He knows you, Gliss said, thrilled by the idea. He does and will.
Renarin supposed that maybe he did. How unusual and how comforting. Renarin, tense at first, leaned against his father, then accepted the offered strength as he watched the future become dust around him.
We need more, Gliss said. We need more like us who will be. Who? I can think of one, Renarin said, who would be a perfect choice.
55. Kinship with the Open Sky. We must not let our desires for a specific result cloud our perceptions. From Rhythm of War, page 6, undertext. With Stormlight, Kaladin had been able to investigate his little hideout, finding it slightly larger than he'd pictured. A stone shelf along one wall gave him a place to put Teft. He'd washed the man, then dressed him in the loose robe with bedpan in place. One of the sacks Kaladin had taken from the monastery, stuffed with clothing, made a makeshift pillow. He'd need blankets, but for now, his friend seemed as comfortable as Kaladin could make him. Teft was still willing to take water, sucking it from the large metal syringe Kaladin brought back. Indeed, Teft lapped up the contents eagerly. He seemed so close to coming awake, Kaladin expected him to start cursing at any moment, demanding to know where his uniform had gone. Syl watched, uncharacteristically solemn.
What will we do if he dies? She asked softly.
Don't think about that, Kaladin said.
What if I can't help thinking about it?
Find something to distract you.
She sat on the stone shelf, hands in her lap.
Is that how you stand it? Knowing everyone is going to die, you just don't think about it?
Basically, Kaladin said,
refilling his syringe from the wooden water jug, then putting the tip into Teft's mouth and slowly emptying it.
Everyone dies eventually.
I won't, she said. Spren are immortal, even if you kill them. Someday I'll have to watch you die.
What brought this on? Kaladin asked. This isn't like you.
Yep, right, of course, not like me.
She plastered a smile on her face.
Sorry.
I didn't mean it that way, Syl, Kaladin said. You don't have to pretend.
I'm not.
I've used enough fake smiles to not be fooled by one. You were doing this earlier, too, before the problems in the tower started. What happened?
She looked down.
I've been remembering what it was like when Relador, my old knight, died. How it made me sleep for so many years straight through the recreants. I keep wondering, will that happen to me again?
Do you feel a darkness? Kaladin asked. A whisper that everything will always turn out for the worst, and at the same time a crippling and baffling impulse pushing you to give up and do nothing to change it?
No, she said, shaking her head. Nothing like that. Just a worry in the back of my mind that I keep circling around to. Like, I have a present I want to open, and I get excited for a little while, only to remember I already opened it and there was nothing inside.
Sounds like how I used to feel when I remembered Tien was dead, Kaladin said. I'd get used to living life as normal, feeling good, only to be reminded by seeing a rock in the rain, or by seeing a wooden carving like the ones he used to do. Then my whole day would come crashing down.
Like that. But it doesn't crash my day down. Just makes me settle back and think and wish I could see him again. It still hurts. Is something wrong with me?
That sounds normal to me. Healthy. You're dealing with a loss when you never really did so before. Now that you're coming fully back to yourself, you're finally confronting things you've been ignoring.
You just told me not to think about it, though, Syl said. Will that actually help?
Kaladin winced. No, it wouldn't. He'd tried. Distractions can be helpful. Doing something, reminding yourself there's a lot out there that's wonderful. But you do have to think about these things eventually, I guess. He filled the syringe again. You shouldn't ask me about this sort of problem. I'm not the best at dealing with them myself.
I feel like I shouldn't have to deal with them, Syl said. I'm a Spren, not a human. If I'm thinking like this, doesn't it mean I'm broken?
It means you're alive, Kaladin said. I'd be more worried if you didn't feel loss.
Maybe it's because you humans created us.
Or it's because you're a little piece of divinity, like you always say. Kaladin shrugged. If there is a god, then I think we could find him in the way we care about one another. Humans thinking about the wind and honor might have given you shape from formless power. But you're your own person now, as I'm my own person, though my parents gave me shape. She smiled at that and walked across the shelf wearing the form of a woman in a hava.
A person, she said. I like thinking like that, being like that. A lot of the other honor Spren, they talk about what we were made to be, what we must do. I talked like that once. I was wrong.
A lot of humans are the same, he said, leaning down so he was eye level with her. I guess we both need to remember that whatever is happening in our heads, whatever it was that created us, we get to choose. That's what makes us people, Syl. She smiled, then her hava bled from a light white blue to a deeper color, striking and distinct, like it was made of real cloth. You're getting better at that, he said. The colors are more vibrant this time. She held up her arms.
I think the closer I get to your world, the more I can become, the more I can change.
She seemed to like that idea and sat, making her dress fade from one shade of blue to another and then to a green. Kaladin finished giving Teft the syringe of water, then held it up. The sides of the metal had fingerprints in them, sunken into the surface. This device had been soul cast into metal after first being formed from wax. The fingerprints were a telltale sign. You can become more things, he said. Like a syringe, maybe? We talked about you becoming other tools.
I think I could do it, she said. If I could manifest as a blade right now, I could change shape to be like that. I think, you imagining it, me believing it, we could do even more. It...
She cut off as a faint scraping sounded outside from near the doorway.
Immediately, Kaladin reached for his scalpel. Syl came alert, zipping up into the air around him as a ribbon of light. Kaladin crept toward the door. He'd covered up the gemstone in the wall on this side with a piece of cloth. He didn't know if his light would shine out or not, but wasn't taking any chances. But he could hear. Someone was out there, their boots scraping stone. Were they inspecting the door? He made a snap decision, slipping his hand under the cloth and pressing it against the stone, commanding it to open. The rocks began to split. Kaladin prepared to leap out and attack the singer on the other side. But it wasn't a singer. It was Dabbid. The unassuming bridgeman wore street clothing, and he stepped away from the door as it opened. He saw Kaladin and nodded to him as if this were all completely expected. "Dabbid?" Kaladin said. Other than Relaine, Dabbid was the only original bridgeman who hadn't manifested Windrunner powers, so it made sense he was awake. But how had he found his way here? Dabbid held up a pot with something liquid inside. Kaladin gave it a sniff. "Broth?" he asked. "How did you know?" Dabbid pointed at the line of crystal on the wall where the Tower Spren's light began to twinkle. Surprising. Along with being mute, the man didn't often volunteer information. Holding the pot awkwardly, Dabbid tapped his wrists together. Bridge 4. "I am so glad to see you," Kaladin said, leading him into the room. "How did you get broth? Never mind. Here, come sit by Teft." Dabbid was one of the first men Kaladin had saved when he'd started administering medical aid to the bridgemen. While Dabbid's physical wounds had healed, his battle shock was the strongest Kaladin had ever seen. Regardless, he was a wonderful sight. Kaladin had been worrying about leaving Teft. If Kaladin died on a mission, that would be a death sentence for Teft, too, unless someone else knew about him. He got Dabbid situated, then showed him the use of the syringe and had him start feeding Teft. Kaladin felt bad putting the mute bridgeman to work as soon as he arrived, but, by Syl's internal clock, night would soon arrive. Kaladin needed to get moving. "I'll explain more when I return," Kaladin promised. "Dabbid, can you get this door open? In case you need to fetch more food and water." Dabbid walked over and put his hand on the door's gemstone. It opened for him as easily as it did for Kaladin. That was somewhat worrisome. Kaladin touched the wall garnet. "Tower Spren?" he asked.
"Yes."
"Is there a way I can lock these doors so they can't be opened by just anyone?"
"It was once possible to attune them to individuals. These days I must simply leave a given door so it can be opened by anyone, or lock it so none can open it."
Well, it was good to know that, in a pinch, he should be able to ask the sibling to lock the door. For now it was enough that Dabbid could get in and out. Kaladin nodded to Syl, left one gemstone to give Dabbid light, then slipped out. Navani had asked Kaladin to observe the oath gates up close as they were activated, to see if he could figure out why they functioned when other fabrials did not. Unfortunately, Kaladin doubted he'd be able to get all the way down to the Oathgate Plateau by sneaking through the hallways of the tower. He had made it to an out-of-the-way monastery on the fourth floor, yes, but that was a long way from the highly populated first two floors. Even if humans weren't confined to quarters, Kaladin couldn't saunter along without getting stopped. Kaladin Stormblessed drew attention. Instead, he wanted to try climbing along the outside of the tower. Before he'd learned to fly, he'd stuck rocks to the chasm wall and climbed them. He figured he could do something similar now. The enemy had plainly ordered the Heavenly Ones to stay inside, and few people went out on the balconies. So he made his way onto a balcony on the 10th floor right as dusk was arriving. He'd tied a sack to his belt, and in it he'd stuffed the 4 scrub brushes he'd gotten from the monastery. Earlier, he'd cut the bristles free with his scalpel, leaving them flat on the front but with a curved handle for holding. Kaladin couldn't paint his hands with a full lashing to stick them to things.
Lopin kept sticking his clothing or hair to the floor, but Aradian's skin seemed immune to the power. Perhaps Kaladin could have rigged some gloves that worked, but the brush handholds seemed sturdier. He leaned out of the balcony and checked to see if anyone was watching. It was growing dark already. He doubted anyone would be able to see him in the gloom, so long as he didn't draw in too much stormlight. By keeping it mostly in the brushes attached to the wall, he wouldn't glow so much that he risked being spotted. At least, the risk of that felt far less than the risk of sneaking through the occupied floors. Best to try it first in a way that wasn't dangerous. Kaladin took out one of the brushes and infused it with stormlight, then pressed the flat side against a pillar on the balcony. With it affixed in place, he was able to hang his entire weight on it, dangling free, without it pulling off or the handle breaking. "Good enough," he said, recovering the stormlight from the lashing. He took off his socks, but replaced his boots. He scanned the air for heavenly ones one last time, then stepped over the side of the balcony and balanced on the little ledge outside. He looked down toward the stones far below. They were lost in the evening darkness. He felt as if he were standing on the edge of eternity. He'd always liked being up high. Even before becoming radiant, he'd felt a certain kinship with the open sky. Standing here, part of him wanted to jump, to feel the rushing wind. It wasn't some suicidal tendency, not this time. It was the call of something beautiful.
"Are you scared?" Syl said.
"No," Kaladin said. "The opposite. I've gotten so accustomed to leaping from high places that I'm not nearly as worried about this as I probably should be." He infused two of the brushes, then moved to the far left side of the balcony. Here the stone wall made a straight path toward the ground between balconies. Kaladin took a deep breath and swung out and slammed one brush against the stone, then the other. He found footholds on the stone, but they were slippery. Once there had been a great deal of ornamentation on the rock out here, but years of high storms had smoothed some of that out. Perhaps Lift could have climbed it without help, but Kaladin was glad he had stormlight. He infused the toes of his boots through his feet, then stuck them to the wall too. He started toward the ground, unsticking one limb, moving it, then sticking it back. Syl walked through the air beside him as if striding down invisible steps. Kaladin found the descent more difficult than he'd anticipated. He had to rely a great deal on his upper body strength, as it was difficult to get the boots to stick right with just the toes. He'd release one brush from the wall, then slide it into place while holding on with only one hand, then move his feet before moving the other. Though radiant, he was sweating from exertion by the time he reached the fifth floor. He decided to take a break and, after having Syl check to make sure it was empty, he moved over and swung onto a balcony. He settled down, breathing deeply, a few spiky cold spren moving across the balcony rail toward him like friendly kremlings. Syl darted into the hallway to make sure nobody was near. Fortunately, the increasingly cold tower and the desire for subterfuge seemed to have convinced most of the invading singers to take quarters far inward. So long as he stayed away from patrols, he should be safe. He sat with his back to the balcony railing, feeling his muscles burn. As a soldier, then a bridgeman, he'd grown accustomed to the sensation of overexerted muscles. He almost felt cheated these days because Stormlight's healing made the feeling rare. Indeed, after he sat for a minute, the sensation was completely gone. Once Syl returned, he resumed his climb. As he did, a couple of windspren drew near, little lines of light that looped about him. As he descended toward the fourth floor, they would occasionally show faces at him, or the outlines of figures, before giggling and flitting off. Syl watched them with fondness. He wanted to ask her what she was thinking, but didn't dare speak lest someone inside hear voices coming in through a window. He took care to press his handholds into place quietly. Kaladin hit a snag as he reached the fourth floor. Syl noticed first, becoming a ribbon and making the glyph for stop in the air beside him. He froze, then heard it. Voices. He nodded to Syl, who went to investigate. He felt her concern through the bond. When Syl was a blade, they had a direct mental connection, but when she was not in that shape, the connection was softer. They'd been practicing on sending words to one another, but they tended to be vague impressions. This time he got a sense of some distinct words.
Singers with spyglasses, third floor balcony, looking up.
Kaladin hung in place, silent as he could be. He could hear them below and to the left on a balcony. They had spyglasses? Why? To watch the sky, he thought, trying to project the idea to Syl. For Windrunner scouts. They won't want to use the Oath Gate until they're certain nobody is watching. Syl returned, and Kaladin started to feel his muscles burning again. He wiped his sweaty brow on his sleeve, then carefully, his teeth gritted, drew in stormlight to release one of his brush handholds. His skin started to release luminescent smoke, but before the light became too obvious, he relashed the brush and stretched out, attaching it to the rock as far to his right as he could reach. He moved to the side, away from the occupied balcony. He could climb across the next balcony over. As he moved, he heard the singers chatting in Alethi. Female in voices, he thought, though some singer forms made gender difficult to distinguish from the voice. Judging by the conversation, they were indeed watching for Windrunners. They did Oathgate transfers at night deliberately, when flying radiance would be starkly visible, glowing in the night sky. Kaladin crossed over two balconies to his right, then continued down another open, flat corridor of stone. He was on the northern part of the tower and had moved west to get away from the scouts. Syl kept checking the nearby balconies as Kaladin continued his methodical pace. Unfortunately, soon after he'd passed the third floor, a dark light flashed from the Oath Gates. It was tinged violet, like void light, but was brighter than a void light sphere. Kaladin took a moment to rest, hanging on but not moving.
"Syl," he whispered, "go check on those scouts on the balcony. Tell me if they're still watching the sky."
She zipped off, then returned a moment later.
"They're packing up their things," she whispered. "Looks like they're leaving."
That was what he'd feared. The enemy would use the Oath Gates as infrequently as possible, as moving singer troops in and out of the tower would expose them to spying eyes. If the scouts were packing up, it was a fairly solid indication that the Oath Gates wouldn't be used again tonight. Kaladin had been too slow. But the gate had flashed with void light, so he knew they'd done something to the Fabril. He'd have to try again tomorrow. He'd moved slower than he'd intended today, but he felt good about the process. A little more practice, and he could probably get down fast enough. But would getting close to the Oath Gates tell him anything about what they had done to them? He didn't feel he knew enough about Fabrials. For now, he started climbing back up to see how much more difficult it was. This was slower, but the footholds with his boots were more helpful. As he ascended, he found a fierce pride in the effort. The changes to the tower had tried to keep him confined to the ground, but the sky was his. He'd found a way to scale her again, if in a less impressive way. Kaladin paused, hanging from his handholds, as something struck him, something that he felt profoundly stupid for having not seen immediately.
"The scouts on the balcony," he whispered to Syl as she darted in to see why he'd stopped. "What would they have done if they'd spotted Windrunners in the sky?"
"They'd have told the others to stop the transfer," Syl said. "So the fact that the Oath Gate glowed the wrong color wouldn't give away the truth."
"How?" Kaladin asked. "How did they contact the Oath Gate operators? Did you see flags or anything?"
"No," Syl said. "They were just sitting there writing in the dark. They must have been using a span read."
One that worked in the tower. Navani was trying to figure out how the enemy was operating Fabrials. What if he could hand her one? Surely that would lead to more valuable information than he would get by observing the Oath Gates. Syl zipped over to the balcony the scouts had been using.
"I can see them," she said. They've packed up, and they're leaving, but they're just ahead.
Follow, Kaladin sent her mentally, then moved as quickly as he could in that direction. He might have missed the knight's transfer, but there was still a way he could help, and it involved stealing that span reed.
56. Nodes. But how can we not, in searching, wish for a specific result? What scientist goes into a project without a hope for what they will find? From Rhythm of War, page 6, undertext. Venli inspected the large model of the tower. Such an intricate construction, a masterwork of sculpting, bathed in violet moonlight through the window. What had it been used for by the Radiants of old, all those years ago? Was this a forgotten art piece, or something more? She'd heard several Voidspren saying that perhaps it was a scale model for the Spren to live in, but for all its intricacy, it didn't have things like furniture or doors. She walked around it, passing through the middle, where it was split to show a cross-section. For some reason, seeing it in miniature highlighted how impossibly vast the tower was. Even reconstructed like this, it was twice Venli's height. She shook her head and left the model behind, moving among the fallen Radiants, each of whom lay silent on the floor of this large chamber. According to Raboniel's request, Venli had found a place to keep them all together. She'd wanted them on the ground floor, close enough to the basement rooms to be sent for, but that region of the tower was quite well occupied. So rather than go to the trouble of kicking people out of a chamber to use, Venli had appropriated this newly discovered and empty one. It had only one entrance, so it was easy to guard, and the window provided natural light. There were around 50 of them in total. Perhaps with such low numbers, Raboniel's forces could have taken this place, even if the Radiants had fought. Perhaps not. There was something about these modern Radiants. The Fused seemed to be constantly surprised by them. Everyone had expected impotence, inexperience. Roshar had gone centuries without the Radiant Bond. These had no masters to train them. They had to discover everything on their own. How did they do so well? Timber pulsed her thoughts on the matter. Sometimes, ignorance was an advantage, as you weren't limited by the expectations of the past. Perhaps that was it. Or perhaps it was something else. New, younger Spren, enthusiastic, pitted against weary old fused souls. Venli lingered near the body of a young woman. The Radiants were each lying on a blanket and draped with a sheet, corpse-like, leaving only their faces exposed. This Radiant, however, was stirring. Her eyes were closed, but her face twitched, as if she were in the grip of a terrible nightmare. She might be. Odium had invaded Venli's mind in the past. Who knew how far his corrupting touch could reach? Windrunner, Venli thought, reading the markings on the floor next to the woman. They listed whatever Venli's team had been able to learn about the individual Radiants from interrogating the tower's humans. She glanced down the row toward another Radiant, whose face was making similar expressions. Also a Windrunner. She finished her inspection and met up with Dull. It had turned out to be simple for Venli to put her most trusted people in charge of the fallen Radiants, as Raboniel thought it a good use for them. The other Windrunners, Venli said softly. Do they all seem closer to waking? Dull asked to awe. Yeah, they do. Anytime one of the Radiants stirs, it's always a Windrunner. We've caught some of them muttering in their sleep. Raboniel asked me specifically to check on this, Venli said to anxiety. She seemed to have anticipated it. Not hard to guess, Dole said. The Radiant who is awake, supposedly roaming the tower, is a Windrunner, right? Venli nodded, looking along the rows of bodies. Venli's loyalists moved among them, administering broth and changing soiled blankets. This was a good maneuver, putting us here, Dole whispered. Caring for the humans gives us an excuse to collect blankets and clothing for when we leave. I've begun putting away broth paste that should keep. Good, Venli said to Anxiety. When only our people are around, test those Windrunners and see if you can wake one up.
And if we succeed? Dull asked to skepticism. I think that's a terrible idea.
Venli's first instinct, even still, was to slap him. How dare he question her? She pushed away that instinct, though it warned her that she was the same selfish person, despite it all. A few words didn't suddenly make her something better. Their powers would be suppressed, Venli explained to him. So they shouldn't be a danger to you, and if they are violent, get away, and let it be assumed they woke up spontaneously. That will keep us from being implicated.
Fine. But why risk it?
Escaping and hiding will be far easier with the help of one like these, Venli said. At the very least, we'll need a distraction to get out. The Windrunners waking and suddenly fighting would provide that. She glanced at Dull, who still hummed to skepticism. Look, Venli said, as they completed a walk around the room. I don't like humans any more than you do. But if we truly want to escape, we'll need to make use of every advantage we can find. She swept her hand across the room of unconscious radiance. This could be a very large one. Finally, Dull hummed to reconciliation.
I suppose you're right. It's worth trying, though I'm not sure how to wake these up. What we need is a surgeon. Could probably use one anyway. Some of these seem to be getting sores and drawing rot spren. Others won't take any broth, though they have hunger spren buzzing around them.
Venli attuned peace as an idea occurred to her. I'm sure I could get you surgeons. In fact, I know of one who might be willing to help our cause, a human. He's in hiding because of certain matters we shouldn't spread. But I think we could place him here to help. Dull nodded, humming to appreciation. Venli left, stepping out onto the floor of the atrium, with the long vertical shaft running up toward the top of the tower. She passed several regals standing guard at the door to the room with the model. Leshwe had told her to put the surgeon and his family someplace safe. Well, this made sense. Curfew was nearing. So here on the floor of the atrium, people were hurrying about their last-minute activities. The humans, no longer confined to quarters, had crept from their shells like vines after a storm. Many of them lived around the atrium, and they had pulled out carts, making temporary shops here near the large window. Like spren to the passions, the humans sought out the sunlight. Tonight they walked timidly and kept their distance from Venli, as if they couldn't believe that they were supposed to continue on as if nothing had happened. Venli found a stairwell and hurried up, causing a few human women to pull to one side and gasp softly, drawing worm-like fear spren. Sometimes, Venli forgot how fearsome her regal form looked. She'd grown comfortable with it, and more it felt like her natural state. Even if there was a void spren trapped in her gem heart. On the second floor, Venli made her way toward a meeting point near the atrium balcony. She was supposed to give service to a team of fused tonight, in case they needed an interpreter. Many fused had trouble speaking to modern singers. That made sense, considering how short a time they'd been back. Venli found it odder that some, like Raboniel, had already learned to speak modern Alethi. Venli arrived at the meeting place, surprised to find several deepest ones, the strange fused with limber bodies and milky white eyes glowing red from behind. They enjoyed spending their time sunken in rock as much as the heavenly ones liked to soar. She had occasionally walked into a room to find one or two of them lingering there, sunken into the floor, revealing only their faces, eyes closed. Tonight, four stood in a clump, attended by a few ordinary singers carrying equipment. The fused were arguing among themselves in their language.
"I did not think the sand would work,"
one of the deepest ones said to spite. Their rhythms sounded off, muted.
"I was right in this. You should acknowledge it." "There are too many different fabrials in the tower," said another, "and too many spren. The device we hunt doesn't leave a strong enough impression to be noticeable, hidden as it is."
"You're searching for the fabrial that is creating the shield around the crystal pillar," Venli guessed. Raboniel had mentioned the field was created by a fabrial, which she theorized would have several gemstones, called nodes, maintaining it, hidden somewhere in the tower. The deepest ones did not directly reprimand her for speaking without first being addressed. As Raboniel's voice, Venli had a certain amount of authority, even with these, not to command, but certainly to speak. "Why not use secret spren?" she asked. "They can find fabrials as easily as they find radiance, can't they?"
"The entire tower is a fabrial," one of the deepest ones said. "The secret spren are useless here. They spin in circles, confused. Asking them to find a specific use of light in here is like asking them to find a specific patch of water in an ocean." "Useless spren," another said. "Have you seen the chaos spren?"
Venli had. Those types of void spren, normally invisible to anyone but the ones they appeared to, left sparks in the air now, as if somehow responding to the dampening field. In this place, even someone who couldn't look into Shadesmar could know whether they were being watched or not. As Venli thought on that, she attuned excitement. No invisible spren, and the secret spren were useless. That meant a radiant in the tower would be free to use their powers without being noticed. She could use her powers without being noticed. The implications of it made Timber begin to thrum to excitement as well, in time with Venli's attunement. Finally! They could practice. Dared she, though?
"Voice,"
one of the deepest ones said, waving her over. It was a female in with pale white skin, swirled with the faintest lines of red.
"We need to find these nodes, but without secret spren, we might have to search the entire tower. You will begin interrogating humans, asking if they've seen a large gemstone that seems unattached from any visible fabrial."
"As you wish, Ancient One," Venli said to abashment. "But if I may say, this seems an inelegant solution. Are the nodes not likely to be hidden?"
"Yes," another said. "But they will also need to be accessible. Their purpose is to let Radiance charge the shield with stormlight."
"Be that as it may, Ancient One, I am skeptical," Venli said. "Assuming humans answered me truthfully, I suspect they would not know anything. They have not finished mapping all the floors of the tower, let alone its secret places. Do you truly wish us to spend months talking to each human, asking them if they've seen something as vague as a random gemstone?" The deepest ones hummed to destruction, but otherwise did not contradict her. As with many of the fused, they did not object out of hand to being challenged, Not if the argument was a good one. Venli could learn from them in that regard.
This is as I said, one said to the others. We could search this place for years and discover nothing.
Won't the nodes be connected to the crystal pillar? Venli asked.
Yes, said one of the deepest ones. By veins of crystal, for transporting stormlight.
Then we could follow those, Venli said. You could sink into the rock and find them, then trace them outward.
No, said another to derision. We cannot see while embedded. We can hear and we can sing, and the tones of Roshar guide us. But this fabrial is made to be silent to us. To trace the lines, we would need to break apart the stone and sever all the connections to the pillar. That might destroy the tower's protections entirely, letting the radiance awaken and defeating our purpose.
So if you did find a gemstone in the tower, Venli said, you couldn't know whether it was tied to the protective field. You might break the gemstone and find it was tied to something else entirely.
The fused hummed at her in derision. Venli was pushing the boundaries of the interference they would accept.
No, foolish one, the femalean said. This fabrial of protection is new, added to the tower after its creation. There will be few other gemstones like it. The rest of the tower works as a single entity, which is why Raboniel was able to engage its protections by infusing it with void light.
That didn't really explain as much as they seemed to think, but Venli hummed to subservience to indicate she appreciated the information and the correction. Her mind, however, was still daunted by the implications of what she'd learned earlier. She'd spent all these months being timid about her powers, telling herself she didn't dare use them. Why was she so worried now, though? Timber pulsed, indicating it was all right to be afraid of trying something new. It was natural. But that wasn't it. Not entirely. It seemed that most of Venli's life, she'd been afraid of the wrong things. Her curiosity had led to her people's downfall. And now she played with powers she didn't understand, gathering an entire group of hopefuls who depended on her. If she made a wrong move, Dull and the others were doomed. The deepest ones conferred. The femalean continued to watch Venli, however. The other three seemed to regard her as their foremost, for they quieted when she spoke.
You are mortal, she said to Venli. You are the last listener. Few regals earn a true title, and I find it odd to see the child of traitors developing one. Tell me, where would you place these nodes if you were to do so?
Venli attuned agony. I have no knowledge of the tower. I couldn't say.
Guess, the fused prompted. Try.
I suppose, Venli said, I would put it someplace easy to give it stormlight, but a place no one would search. Or,
a thought occurred to her, but she quieted it. She didn't want to help them. The longer it took to fully corrupt the tower, the better it seemed for her people.
No, never mind. I am foolish, ancient one, and ignorant.
Perhaps, but you are also mortal, and think like one, the fused considered. Mortals are busy. They live short lives, always staffed with so many things to do, yet they are also lazy. They want to do none of what they should. Would you not say this is true?
Yes, of course, Venli said. This was not a fused wanting someone to object.
Yes, said another deepest one. Would they not put the gemstone nodes at least one of them where Stormlight could renew it naturally. Storms reach this high only occasionally, another said, but they do come up here, so it would make sense to put one in reach of the occasional free infusion of power.
Timber pulsed to sorrow inside Venli. This was exactly the idea she'd chosen not to share. Where was the best place for a node? Outside, somewhere, but not on the balconies, where it could be spotted. She looked across the atrium toward the large window. The deepest ones had come to the same conclusion, apparently, for they flowed away toward the far wall to look for signs of a gemstone embedded outside. Timber pulsed to disappointment. I didn't try to help, Venli whispered. Besides, they mostly figured it out on their own. Timber pulsed again. Hopefully it would turn out to be nothing. It was just a guess, after all. The fused had left her with no instructions, so she remained with the servants until she spotted a familiar figure hurrying through the corridor. Mazish, Dull's wife, one of Venli's inner circle. She stepped forward quickly, intercepting the squat work form, who was humming to anxiety. What? Venli asked. Venli, she said. Venli, they found another. Another radiant? Venli asked in confusion. No, not that. I mean, she seized Venli by the arm, another one of you, another listener. 57. Child of Odium. 8.5 years ago. Eshonai found the humans endlessly fascinating. Between their first and second visits, Eshonai had organized several trips to try to find their homeland. Suddenly, everyone had wanted to join her, and she'd led large expeditions. Those had been all song and no crescendo, unfortunately. The only thing she'd been able to locate was a solitary human outpost to the west. They told her to expect a second visit soon, but now that visit seemed to be drawing to a close. So Eshonai took every remaining opportunity to watch the humans. She loved the way they walked, the way they talked, even the way they looked at her, or sometimes didn't. Like today, as she strolled through Gavilar Colin's camp. His servants barely glanced at her as they packed. She stepped up beside one worker, who was unstringing a large metal bow. The man must have seen her standing there, but when he stood up a few minutes later, he jumped to find her beside him. Such strange behavior. Sometimes she thought she could read the rhythms in the human motions, like that man with the bow would be attuned to anxiety. Yet they still didn't seem to grasp that listeners could hear something they could not. What would it be like to go about all the time without a rhythm in your head? It must be painful, or lonely, so empty. The various humans continued their packing, storing everything in wagons for the day's storm. The humans were good at judging the arrival of those. Though they were often wrong on the hour, they were usually right on the day. This, however, was no routine pre-storm packing job. They would soon leave. She could read this in the way they talked to each other, the way they double-checked bindings and folded tents with more precision than usual. They weren't planning to unpack any of it for a while. She wished they would stay longer. Their first interaction had been so short, and now this second visit was over almost before it began. Perhaps she could go with them, as she'd told Venli. She'd asked how far beyond the hills their home was, but they didn't answer and refused to share their maps. Eshonai moved to slip out of camp, but stopped as she noticed one man standing off from the rest. Dalinar Colin looked out, eastward, toward the origin of storms. Curious, Eshonai walked up to him, noting that he had his shard blade out. He held it lightly before him, the tip sunken into the stone. He seemed to be searching for something, but before him stretched only the plains, an empty expanse. Unlike the others, he noticed her approach immediately, turning as she made the slightest scrape on the stones while walking. She froze beneath his gaze, which always seemed to be the stare of a great shell.
"You're one of the interpreters," he said.
"Yes."
"What was your name?"
"Eshonai," she said, though she had little doubt he'd forget again. The humans didn't seem to be able to distinguish very well between different listeners.
"Have you been out there?"
he asked, nodding toward the plains.
"To the center?"
"No," she said. "I'd like to go, but the old bridges, they do not stand. It would take work, much work, to put them back. Most of my people don't like, what is the word? Going where it is difficult to go?"
"Exploring, perhaps," he said.
"Yes, exploring. We once exploring, but now very little exploring,
until recently." He grunted. "You're good with our language."
"I like it," she said. "Speaking new ways, thinking new ways. They are same, yes?"
"Yes, perhaps they are."
He turned and looked over his shoulder toward the west, toward his homeland.
"Perhaps your people are afraid to return to where they once lived."
"Why fear that?" Eshonai asked, attuning confusion.
"Places have power over us, Parsh woman," he said. "Places have memories. Sometimes when you go to a place you've never been, it can be wonderful, because it lets you be someone else. No expectations, no storming memories."
"I like new places," she said, "because they are new." She attuned irritation. That hadn't come out as she'd wanted it to. She felt stupid speaking their language. It was difficult to express anything deep while speaking it, because the rhythms didn't match the words.
"Wise words," Dalinar said.
"Wise words?" Was he being patronizing? Humans seemed to not expect much from her people, and were surprised whenever a complex conversation happened, as if they were amused that the listeners were not as dull-minded as Parshmen. "I would like to go to see places where you live," Eshonai said. "I would visit you, and have you visit us more." Dalinar dismissed his blade, sending it away with a puff of white fog. She attuned confusion.
"My brother has taken an interest in you," Dalinar said softly. "This, well, be more cautious with your invitations, Parsh woman. Our attention can be dangerous."
"I do not understand," she said. It sounded as if he were warning her against his own.
"I have grown tired of pushing people around," Dalinar said. "In my wake, I've left too many smoldering holes where cities used to be. You are something special, something we've never seen before. And I know my brother. I know that look in his eyes, that excitement. His interest could benefit you, but it could have an equal cost. Do not be so quick to share your storm shelter with men you just barely met. Don't offend, but also don't be too quick to bend. Any new recruit needs to learn both lessons. In this case, I'd suggest politeness, but care. Do not let him back you into a corner. He will respect you if you stand up for yourselves. And whatever you do, don't give him any reason to decide he wants what you have."
"Be forceful, stand up for themselves, but don't offend their king." How did that make any sense? Yet looking at him, listening to his calm but firm voice, she thought she did understand his intent, as if given to her by a rhythm. "Be careful with us," was what he was saying. We are far more dangerous than you think. He had mentioned burning cities. How many cities do your people live in? She asked.
Hundreds, he said. The number of humans in our realm would stagger you. It is many times the number of Parshmen I've seen here living with you.
Impossible. That was impossible, wasn't it? We know so little. Thank you, she said to appreciation. She got it to click, the way of speaking his language but putting a rhythm to it. It could work. He nodded to her.
We are leaving. I realize this visit was short, but my brother needs to return to his lands. You will certainly meet us again. We will send a more permanent envoy. I promise you this.
He turned, moving with the momentum of a shifting boulder, and walked toward his storm wagon. Venli felt as if the bright red gemstone would burn its way through her clothing. She huddled in one of the storm shelters, a group of wide slits in the ground near the city, which they'd covered over with animal carapace and creme. Each was in the top of a hill, so the sides could drain. Venli's immediate family gathered together in this one to chat and feast, as was their habit during storm days. The other seemed so cheerful, speaking to joy or appreciation while they ate beside the fire, listening as Venli's mother sang songs by the light of uncut gem hearts. Those could be organic, lumpish things. While they took in stormlight, none were nearly as bright as the strange gemstone in her pocket, the one the human had given her. Venli felt as if it should be on fire, though it was as cold as a normal gemstone. She attuned anxiety and glanced at the others, worrying they'd see that too red glow. I'm supposed to go out into the storm, she thought, listening to the rain pound distant stone. Does this count? I can see the storm out there, flashing and making its own rhythm, too frantic, too wild. No. She wasn't close enough. Hiding in one of these shelters wouldn't allow her to adopt mate form, which was the sole transformation they did regularly. No one wanted to go back to dull form, after all. There were other forms to be found. She'd been close to war form, and now, this gemstone. She'd carried it for weeks, terrified of what might happen. She glanced at her mother and the close family members who sat and listened, enraptured by the beautiful songs. Even Venli, who had heard them hundreds of times, found herself wanting to drift back and sit at her mother's feet. None of them knew what was happening. To Jaxlim, mother hid it well. Was it true that other forms could help her? The humans were leaving now. So this was the last chance Venli would have to try the gemstone, then, if it didn't work, get answers from the human who had given it to her. Venli attuned determination and rose from her place, walking toward the end of the shelter, where they tied their gemstones to be renewed, close enough for the storm to be given light by the rider's touch. Several of the others whispered behind her, their voices attuned to amusement. They thought she had decided to adopt mate form, which she'd always been adamant she would never do. Her mother had smiled when she'd asked, explaining that few ever intended to adopt mate form. She acted as if it was simply something that happened, that an urge overtook you, or you sat too close to the exit during a storm. Then, poof, the next thing you knew, you'd become a silly idiot looking to breed. It was embarrassing to think others assumed Venli was doing that now. She reached the wet stone at the edge of the shelter, where Rainspren clustered with eyes pointed upward and grasping claws below. The wind and thunder were louder here, like the war calls of a rival family trying to frighten her away. Perhaps it would be best just to give the gemstone to her mother, and let her go try to find the new form. Wasn't that what this was about? No, Venli thought, trembling. No, it's not. Months spent trying to find new forms had gotten her nowhere, while Eshonai gained more and more acclaim. Even their mother, who had called her explorations foolish, now spoke of Eshonai with respect. The person who had found the humans, the person who had changed the world. Venli had done what she was supposed to. She'd remained with her mother. She'd spent endless days memorizing songs, dutiful. But Eshonai got the praise. Before her nerves betrayed her, Venli stepped out onto the hillside, entering the storm. The force of the wind made her stumble and slide down the slick rock. In an eye blink, she went from sheltered, song-filled warmth to icy chaos, a tempest with sounds like instruments breaking and songs failing. She tried to hold to the rhythm of resolve, but it was the rhythm of winds by the time she scrambled behind a large boulder and pressed her back against the stone. From there, her mind devolved to the rhythm of pleading, bordering on panic. What was she doing? This was insanity. She'd often mocked those who went out in the storms without shields or other protections. She wanted to return to the shelter, but she was too frightened to move. Something large crushed the ground nearby, causing her to jump. But a moment of darkness in the howling tempest prevented her from seeing how close the impact had been, as if the lightning, the wind, and the rain all conspired against her. She reached into her pocket and took out the gemstone. What had seemed so bright before now seemed frail. The red light barely illuminated her hand. Break it. She was supposed to break it. With fingers already numb from the cold, she searched around, eventually finding a large stone. The ground was shattered here in a circle the size of a listener. She retreated to the relative shelter of the boulder, shivering as she held the gemstone in one hand, the rock in the other. Then silence. It was so sudden, so unexpected, that she gasped. The rhythms in her mind became as one, a single steady beat. She looked upward into pure blackness. The ground around her seemed dry all of a sudden. She slowly turned around, then huddled down again. There was something in the sky. Something like a face made from clouds and natural light, the impression of something vast and unknowable.
You wish to take this step?
A not voice said, vibrating through her like a rhythm. I. This was him, the Spren of High Storms, the Rider of Storms. The songs called him a traitor.
You have spent so long as children of no god, the rhythm said to her. You would make this choice for all of your people?
Venli felt both a thrill and a terror at those words. So there was something in the gemstone? My people need forms, she shouted up toward the vast entity.
This is more than forms. This power changes mortals.
Power? You served our enemies, she called to the sky. How can I trust what you say?
Yet you trust the gift of one of those enemies? Regardless, I serve no one. Not man or singer. I simply am. Farewell. Child of the plains, child of odium.
The vision ended as abruptly as it had begun, and Venli was again in the storm. She nearly dropped her burdens in shock, but then, huddling against the gleeful wind, she set the glowing gemstone on the ground. She gripped the rock in her hand, slick with rain. She wavered. Should she take more care? What greatness was achieved by being careful, though? Esho and I hadn't been careful, and she'd discovered a new world. Venli slammed the stone downward and crushed the gem. Light escaped in a puff, and she winced in the pelting rain, bracing herself for a wondrous transformation.
"Finally," a voice said to the rhythm of irritation. "That was unpleasant."
The red light turned into a tiny human male, standing with hands on hips, glowing faintly in the storm. Venli pulled her arms in tight, shivering, blinking rainwater out of her eyes.
"Spren," she hissed. "I have summoned you to grant me one of the ancient forms." "You?" he asked. "How old are you? Are there any others I could talk to?"
"Show me this secret first," she said. "Then we will give your form to others. It can heal them, right? That is what I was told." He didn't reply.
"You will not deny me this," Venli said, though her words were lost in a sudden peal of thunder. "I've suffered long to accomplish this goal." "Well, you're certainly dramatic," the little Spren said, tapping his foot. "Guess we use the tools we find in the shed, even if they've got a little rust on them. Here's the deal. I'm going to take up residence inside of you, and together we're going to do some incredible things."
"We will bring useful forms to my people?" Venli asked, her teeth chattering.
"Well, yes, and also no. For a while, we'll need you to appear as if you are still in work form. I need to scout out how things are on old Roshar these days. It's been a while. You think you can get into Shadesmar if we need to?"
Shadesmar? She asked.
"Yes. We need to get to the storm there. The newer one in the south? Where I entered that gemstone? You have no idea what I'm talking about. Delightful. Right then, get ready. We've got a lot of work to do."
Eshonai attuned anxiety as she stood by the mouth of the shelter, searching for her sister. She couldn't make out much in the tempest. The flashes of lightning, though brilliant, were too brief to give her a real picture of the landscape.
"She really did it, did she?"
Thud asked to amusement as he stepped up beside her, chewing on some fruit.
"After all that complaining, she sauntered out to become a mate."
"I doubt it," Eshonai said. "She's been trying to find war form for months now. She's not looking to become a mate. She's too young, anyway." The humans had been surprised at how young Eshonai and Venli were. Apparently, humans aged more slowly. But Venli was still months away from official adulthood.
"Younger ones have made the decision," Thud said, rubbing at his beard. "I've thought about it, you know. There's a certain bond to once mates."
"You just think it sounds fun," Eshonai said to reprimand. He laughed.
"I do at that."
Thunder shook the enclosure, silencing both of them for a time as they listened to it, both attuning the rhythm of winds out of deference. There was something wondrous, if dangerous, about feeling the very vibrations of the storm.
"This isn't the time to be distracted by something silly like mate form," Eshonai said.
"The humans are leaving again once this storm ends. We should be talking about sending someone with them."
"You're too responsible for your own good sometimes, Eshonai," Thud replied, his arm up against the top of the enclosure as he leaned forward, letting the rain hit his face.
"Me? Responsible?" she said. "Mother might have words for you on that topic."
"And each one would remind me how alike the two of you are," Thud said, attuned to joy and grinning at the storm like a fool. "I'm going to do it one of these days, Eshonai. I'm going to see if Bila will go with me. Life is meant to be more than working the fields or chopping wood."
With that, Eshonai could agree. And she supposed she could understand someone wanting to do something different with their life. None of them would exist if their parents hadn't decided to become mates.
The idea still made her want to attune anxiety. She disliked how much that form changed the way people thought. She wanted to be herself, with her own desires and passions, not let some form override her. Of course, there was an argument that she was even now influenced by work form. She attuned determination and put that out of her mind. Venli, where was she? Escher and I knew she shouldn't fear for her sister. Listeners went into the storms all the time, and while it was never strictly safe, she didn't need to hum to anxiety like the humans did when they talked of storms. Storms were a natural part of life, a gift from Roshar to the listeners. Though a little piece of Eshonai, a part she hated to acknowledge, noted how much easier life would be without Venli around, complaining all the time, without her jealousy. Everything Eshonai did, every conversation or plan or outing, was made harder when Venli decided to be involved. Complications would materialize out of calm air. It was weakness in Eshonai that she should feel this way. She was supposed to love her sister, and she didn't really want harm to come to Venli, but it was difficult not to remember how peaceful it had been to explore on her own, without any of Venli's drama. A figure appeared out of the storm, slick with rain, backlit by lightning. Eshonai felt guilty again, and attuned joy by force upon seeing it was Venli. She stepped out into the storm and helped her sister the rest of the way. Venli remained in work form, a wet, shivering femalean in work form.
"Didn't work, eh?"
Thud asked her. Venli looked at him, as mute as a human, her mouth opening a little. Then, unnervingly, she grinned, a frantic, uncharacteristic grin. "No, Thud," Venli said. "It didn't work. I will have to try many, many more times to find war form." He hummed to reconciliation, eyeing Eshonai. She'd been right. It hadn't been about mate form, after all. "I should like to sit by the fire," Venli said, "and warm myself."
"Venli?" Eshonai said. "Your words? Where are their rhythms?"
Venli paused. Then she, as if it were a struggle, began humming to amusement. It took her a few tries.
"Don't be silly," Venli said. "You just weren't listening."
She strode toward the fire, walking with a swagger that seemed even more confident than normal. The high-headed stroll of a femalean who thought that the storms began and ended upon her whims.
58. Span reads. "I find this experience so odd. I work with a scholar from the ancient days before modern scientific theory was developed. I keep forgetting all the thousands of years of tradition you completely missed." From Rhythm of War, page 6, undertext. Kaladin landed on the balcony with a muted thump. Syl was a glowing ribbon of light farther into the building. He couldn't see the scouts who had packed up and left with the span reeds, but he trusted Syl was watching them. He followed into the darkness, putting his stormlight into a sphere so he didn't glow. He had failed to spy on the oath gates, but if he could somehow steal one of those void-light span reeds, he could still help Navani. He crept as quickly as he dared in the darkness, one hand on the wall. He soon neared a hallway with lanterns along the wall. As this was the third floor of the tower, much of it was occupied and lit. The lanterns revealed two female and singers ahead, wearing havas and chatting quietly. Syl carefully darted into the side tunnels and nooks behind them. Kaladin trailed far behind, relying on Syl to point out turns, as the two singers were often out of his direct line of sight. This section of the tower was a large laundry facility where dark eyes could come to use public water and soap. He passed several large rooms without doors where the floor was shaped into a sequence of basins. It was nearly empty now. The tower's pumps hadn't been changed to work on void light, it seemed. He did have to avoid several water-carrying teams, humans pulling carts with Singer guards, moving through the tunnels. Syl soon came zipping back, so he ducked into a darkened alcove near an empty room full of baskets for laundry. The place smelled of soap.
"Guard post ahead," she whispered. "They went through it. What do you want to do?"
"Any fused nearby?" Kaladin asked.
"Not that I saw. Only ordinary Singers."
"Theoretically, regular guards shouldn't be able to see you unless you let them. Follow those Singers with the span reeds. Hopefully their rooms are nearby. If they split up, pick the one with the blue hava. The embroidery indicates she's the more important. Once you know where her room is, come back, then we can sneak in another way and steal the span reed."
"Right. If they get too far away from you, though, I'll lose myself."
"Return if you start to feel that," he said. "We can try another night." Syl soared off without another word, leaving Kaladin hiding inside the room with the baskets. Unfortunately, he soon heard voices and peeked to see a pair of Singers with baskets walking down the hallway. Even an occupying force of ancient evil soldiers needed to do laundry, it seemed. Kaladin closed the door, shutting himself in darkness, then, realizing there was a chance they were coming to dump their baskets in this very room, he grabbed a broom and lashed it across the door. Since he'd infused the broom on either end, no stormlight should show through the door. A moment later, it rattled as they tried to push it inward. Annoyed voices outside complained in Azish as they tried the door again. He gripped his knife, darkness weighing upon him. The horror of the nightmares, and a fatigue that went far deeper than the earlier strain to his muscles. A tiredness that had been with him so long he'd accepted it as normal. When the door rattled again, he was certain it was a dark force come to claim him. He heard the sounds of bowstrings and of gas yelling for the bridgemen to run, screams of men dying, and he blinked. The door had fallen still. When had that happened? He gave it a few minutes, wiping the sweat from his forehead, then unlashed the broom and cracked the door. Two abandoned baskets sat nearby, no Singers in sight. He let out a long breath, then pried his fingers off his scalpel and tucked it away. Eventually, Syl returned.
"They weren't going to their rooms,"
she said, animatedly dancing around in patterns as a ribbon of light.
"They dropped off their span reed in a room ahead where there are dozens of span reeds, watched over by a couple of senior femalins."
Kaladin nodded, breathing deeply, fighting back the tiredness.
"You all right?" Syl asked.
"I'm fine," Kaladin said. "That's a span reed hub you found. Makes sense they'd set one up in the tower." Maintaining hundreds of span reeds could grow unwieldy. So many high lords and high ladies would set up hubs. Disparate locations, like guard posts around the tower, could send reports to a central room where the hub attendants sifted for important information and sent it to those in power. The Singers were keeping their reeds in central locations to be checked out, used, and returned. The reeds wouldn't go home with individual scribes. This wasn't going to be as easy as sneaking into a bedroom to grab one, but the hub might offer other opportunities. "We need to get past that guard post," Kaladin whispered, burying his fatigue.
"There's something else, Kaladin," Syl said. "Look out the door down the tunnel."
Frowning, he did as she requested, peeking out and watching down the tunnel. He was confused until he saw something pass in the air, like rippling red lightning.
"That's a new kind of void spren," he said.
The ones he'd seen in the past that looked like lightning moved along the ground.
"It's not, though," Syl said. "That spren should be invisible to people, but something is off about its aura. It is leaving a trail that I noted the guards watching."
Curious. So the tower was interfering with spren invisibility? "Did the guards look at you when you passed?"
"No, but they might just not have noticed me."
Kaladin nodded, watching a little longer. That spren in the distance didn't pass again. It's worth the risk, he decided, in proceeding. At least we'll know if we're being spied upon.
But what about that guard post? She asked.
I doubt we'll be able to sneak around it, he said. They'll have all directions guarded for something valuable like a span read hub. But a lot of these rooms have small tunnels at the tops for ventilation. Perhaps we can sneak through one of those? Syl led him carefully to an intersection. He peered right to where four guards blocked the way, two at either side of the hallway. Spears at the crooks of their arms, they wore Alethi-style uniforms with knots on the shoulders. Kaladin was able to spot one of the ventilation holes nearby, but this one was far too small for him to squeeze into. He'd stood on guard duty himself like that on a number of occasions. If these four were well-trained, there would be no luring them away with simple distractions. If you wanted a path well-protected, you often posted four. Two to investigate any disturbances, two to remain vigilant. With the hallway this narrow and with those guards looking as alert as they were, well, he'd been there. The only times when he'd been drawn away, it had involved someone with proper authority commandeering him for another task.
Syl, he whispered, you're getting better at changing colors. Do you think you could change your coloring to appear like a void spren?